Blog Talk Radio.
It's not just Washington that is broken, it's America who is asleep at the wheel. Why do they tell us that the Constitution is outdated? Can you outdate liberty? This is Brett Rappaport, and you are listening to the Final Say Radio Show. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the Final Say Radio Show. It's Brett and John Rappaport and Andrew on the boards, as always. So glad you're joining us on this fine afternoon. And well, I'm going to start off the show in this manner. I got to tell you, it's really amazing to me. And I don't know why I do it, when I hardly do it anymore, because it's... This is nothing to ever be gained about arguing with idiots. And in this particular case, I define idiots as lefties, liberal lefties, the Obama types, those kind of idiots, the morons who have dug this once just thriving nation with an incredible middle class, just so filled with hope and future, into the ground. That's what they've done. And so someone I know, he's a comedian, but he's also a lawyer, and he's also a, he's an intelligent guy, and he's got a lot to say about politics and things of that nature. And I just had to comment on something he wrote. But, of course, my comment was directed at his making fun of something, and he's a funny guy. He's a comedian. And so I half agreed with what he said, but I complimented him on the comedy part of what he said. So, of course, all of his liberal retarded friends, yes, I said that's exactly how I'm phrasing it, had to chime in about Bush, Reagan, Nixon, Ford, really, as if any of those guys are responsible for the BS that we are experiencing now. As if the Middle East is on fire right now. Russian tanks rolling into Ukraine. I mean, as all this stuff is happening right now because of Richard Nixon or Gerald Ford, guys who were long buried. It's just not happening right now. Anyway, it's really incredible. I don't understand for the life of me where these guys, get their facts and information and whatnot. But here's the thing I want to say. There's certain facts that you can't deny. And here's part of them. Thank you.
I think we're up to be on air, Pete. Okay, then I am.
Thank you.
I think we're back now. Vito, do you hear me? If you do, tell me in chat. Hopefully we've got this fixed now. Boy. Well, we'll have, sorry about that, folks. John and Mudar will be back with us momentarily, and we'll get back to this business that we call. And yes, you finally hear me. Thank you, Vito. So glad that you're in there. And, well, sometimes when somebody else gets involved in the process, things get a little bit twisted, and they include the person who's supposed to actually be running the call board. But that's okay. We've got it fixed. Anyway, just a moment. We'll have Mudar Zaran and my co-host here, John, back on with our discussion. I believe we have him now, so let me check that. Okay, fellows, are you back with us?
Well, you have John. Give me 1 second. I'm pulling in Mudar. This is part
okay.
of the joy in the chat.
Well, that's why doing second. Live is fun. Okay, I'll put you back on hold for a sec. Anyway, so what we were discussing that you couldn't hear, but we will touch back on these topics. Very complicated. I mean, I said yesterday there's so many complications to international relations and geopolitical affairs because you have so many players, and too often, regardless of what country you are, in this case, we're the United States. When you're discussing something, you're always looking at it from your best interest, your viewpoint. But when you're looking at everything, you have to look at all these situations from the perspective of all sides involved. And I just want to introduce something, and then we'll get back into our conversation here, Mudar and John. But it occurred to me that so often when you make policy decisions or get involved in international affairs, there are always what we would refer to as, the unintended consequences. But there's something that also happens that needs to be discussed more, and that is the intended consequences. And I think a lot of the decisions being made by all the players in all these situations we're involved with are well aware of the intended consequences. Even though we may view them as bad, they understand they're going to happen. In fact, I think often they want them to happen. So the question I would have for you, Mudar, and then we could touch on some of the things we've already said that might not have been heard, but when IS, the Islamic State, decided to take the Jordanian pilot and do what they did and create this video and go public with that, they had to understand there would be a price to pay or repercussions in the Middle East, at the very least, for that action. I call that the intended consequences. Now, the unintended consequences will be those that they didn't anticipate happen, which will. And we'll see how this plays out. But your thoughts on that idea? Mudar?
Hello.
Yes.
I'm listening. I didn't hear the last sentence.
Oh, I was saying your thoughts on the intended and unintended consequences of some of the actions that we see happening right now, particularly those taken by the Islamic State, but also some of the actions of the king or some of the other players in this particular region that you're so concerned with?
Well, basically, we need to start with this to make it clear to all the listeners. This is Islamic State does not want Amman, does not want Israel. Islamic State wants to eventually go to the White House. They made that very clear a long time ago that they're going to put their flag on the White House. This is what they want. Sooner or later, they're coming to America. It's just a matter of time when they attack next and when there's another 9/11 in America. So this is top American concern, top American issues. It's not a laughing matter by any chance, or it's not a regional issue. That said, where Jordan is now, thanks to Jordan's army, is in almost full-scale war with the ISIS, and the Jordanian army has actually decided ultimately to go full-scale Rambo against ISIS. The Jordanian army, people have to notice, Jordan deserves all the support that could be given to it at the moment because it's spearheading the fight. But who is spearheading the fight? When our boy was burnt alive, the Jordanian army breached protocol and went on state television to make a political decision and a political statement. This has never happened in Jordan's history. In addition, they even spoke before the king spoke, and they said they made the decision for themselves. Of course, this is because the king said on Charlie Rose's show that he refuses a ground war against ISIS. The army is in charge. The army has made this decision. The king, as I have always been saying, has no control over Jordan's army. The army is American-trained, American-equipped, and American-funded. And this is all now army versus ISIS. And the army, the king, is, his power and grip over the country is becoming weaker by the day. It was a huge, huge change for the army to take the initiative instead of the king. And even in his speech, he was very mild on ISIS. He didn't even indicate any ground war. And he was much, much more mild than the army. So basically what we have now is two things. This is a full ground war against ISIS in which the U.S. must support, finance, and defend. And this is also a huge change in, with a major U.S. ally, Jordan, where it seems that the army has taken over. Will the army depose the king in 1 year from now or 2 years from now? We don't know. But again, there was a report by the very usually least spoken Mossad that they thought that the king of Jordan was not going to keep the kingdom. So stay tuned. We're going to watch a lot of changes in Jordan that does affect American interests at heart.
Now, Madar, given the conversation as Brett started it, the idea of intended and unintended consequences, clearly the intended consequences of the PR stunt of a horrific murder of a Jordanian pilot, and probably more specifically a pilot with an influential and large family, has the immediate effect, I would think, of as these things happen in most countries, of creating an immediate level of support both for the king and a sense of patriotism, you know, in the country at large. But the unintended consequences may be from the Jordanian perspective, but absolutely intended from the ISIS perspective would be to use this event as a means of drawing Jordan into some actions or activities militarily or otherwise that they wouldn't want to do, as well as potentially to foment divisiveness. And so I wanted to get your perspective. What are the key risk factors that ISIS could potentially successfully exploit that might have to do with either the refugees or the division between the president and particularly the Palestinian masses, who you personally take a greater concern about, and also the relationship between Jordan and Israel, because ISIS is the one who stands to gain from chaos?
Well, the Palestinians, first of all, the pilot who was killed is half Palestinian. His tribe is in between both countries, Israel and Jordan. His tribe, Al-Masa'id, is in Bethlehem and around Bethlehem all over the West Bank. So the boy has injured, or his death has hurt all of those masses on both sides of the river to the extreme. In addition, there was pockets of support for ISIS in Jordan, particularly within the Bedouins in the south. ISIS flag has been hanging over a southern city in Jordan for the last 8 months. It was pulled down just when the boy was killed. And it has greatly done an incredible damage to the image of the ISIS within the Jordanians. I see that they are unified in this. The Palestinians in Jordan, as much as they hate Israel and have anti-Semitic views, they are not Islamist. I'm not sugarcoating this. I'm saying my people in the West Bank are more radical than ISIS. On the other hand, my people in Jordan are very westernized, but they hate Israel. So I'm just describing things as they are without no sugarcoating, no rosy photos here. Nonetheless, today they are all unified against ISIS. I've seen a known political figure in Jordan who was a known ISIS sympathizer, who's now calling for revenge from ISIS. The refugee camp leaders are calling openly for revenge against ISIS. So everyone's unified with the army against ISIS today. Now, inside internal chaos, it's not going to happen. But we have a side effect, which is going to be ISIS is going to be bombing the hell out of Jordan. ISIS has already pledged openly that they will, quote-unquote, we will bomb your hotels and your homes again. And ISIS could do that. We all know terrorism is a very cheap crime and a very easy crime to conduct. So we will see a very tough, bloody show in Jordan, unfortunately, all through this year.
Yeah, you know, to your point, Mudar, and I just wanted to say that, you know, we've had this discussion, and you feel very strongly that it would make sense to have two states, the state of Jordan, Palestine, whatever you want to call it. In other words, the people who are now in the West Bank and Gaza would move into Jordan, and in Israel would be what Israel is, and then you'd at least have these natural lines of separation, which may alleviate some of the issues between the two states. But I agree with you. I don't think that the dislike for one another or any of those issues that exist are going to just go away.
Well, absolutely, it's not going to go away. This is epic. This is going to last for a very long time. But again, this is like building a high wall or high fence between two bad neighbors. And that's we all get it through common sense. The view for Israel is not going to change. The hatred for Israel is not going to change anytime soon. We need basically reformist leaders who would take the initiative like Sisi of Egypt did. Until that happens in Jordan, we're not going to witness any change. But until the Palestinians basically grow out of this phase that they are in, we need to keep my people in the right place and under adult supervision. And that adult supervision might as well happen in Jordan, under Jordan's army tight grip. And that's what we hope for. Either way, when the king goes away, and he will go away, I mean, all of those who were opposing me, telling me it's nonsense, the king is just fine, I mean, would the chief of the U.S. Army make a statement about going to war before the U.S. president does that? It's not going to happen. Imagine when it happens to you while you are king, while you're considered a god, the ultimate ruler of Jordan, and one of your commanders makes a statement without even going back to you. So it shows you that there is change coming. As I said before, when change arrives, 5, 10, 1 year, 2 years, 6 months, 3 days, I don't know, 20 years, eventually the Palestinian majority is going to elect the Palestinian president. No question about that. And then, you know, Palestinian president, Palestinian parliament, Palestinian government, well, if it looks like a duck, it is a duck. And I always ask the same funny question. How many states are we Palestinians going to have? We already have one in the West Bank, and we have another one in Gaza. And President Sisi, out of the kindness of his heart and out of his commitment to peace, is offering another Palestinian state in Sinai. And we're going to have a state in Jordan soon, sooner or later. And what's next? A Palestinian state in New Jersey?
Well, I don't know. We don't know exactly who showed up at the White House yesterday, so there may be a Palestinian flag flying in the Oval Office for all we know. But in all seriousness, I think it's a very important issue that you bring up, and you know this all goes to the importance of having, you know, as we would often call, rational and irrational actors, right? You know, ISIS is obviously an irrational actor. But there's two very important rational actors here that whose actions may be irrational, but they're fixed, controlling, very powerful entities who have been at war for eons. One, of course, is Iran. The other is Saudi Arabia. Speaking of kings who you know, who don't get to live forever, and hopefully this one will follow the other one soon enough. Not a death wish there, more so not being in charge of running a country. But between those two, I wanted to get your sense. Jordanians in general and Palestinian Jordanians specifically, how does the Sunni-Shia divide play out? And along with those, how do they view the obvious, again, put America aside, including all of Obama's, you know, complete leadership vacuum failures, just purely in a vacuum, looking in a Middle Eastern vacuum, looking at Iran and Saudi Arabia, how do those and the Sunni-Shia divide play into this long-term picture?
Well, we very few Americans realize that Saudi Arabia today is the strongest ally the U.S. has after Israel against terrorism. Saudi Arabia is not the perfect country. It has issues with human rights, women's rights. Nonetheless, Saudi Arabia is a stable ally who is ruthless with Islamists, who doesn't have a media that attacks Israel, who values Israel's existence unofficially, while without making it public. At least they don't harass Israel. They have been providing a wealth of intelligence information to the U.S. government, and they have been, for the last 5 years, spearheading the fight against the Islamists, and most of the operations against ISIS have been carried out by state-of-the-art Saudi F-15 jets. The Saudis are doing a good job in downsizing Iran and downsizing ISIS at the same time. Never mind what you hear about it. And this is where, honestly, I get the idea of how misled some Americans are by the constant attacks in Saudi Arabia. Yes, Saudi Arabia is an Islamic state, but it's not an Islamist with the T state. And it's very essential in the war on terror. Iran is already suffering with what Saudi Arabia did, which is producing too much oil, sending the oil prices sinking and making Iran starving for cash. This is something Saudi Arabia strongly did and should be thanked for. So Saudi Arabia is losing up to, today, as we speak, is losing up to $350 million a day just to teach Iran a lesson. That's something to be appreciated. The Jordanian public is most interested in the Shiite-Sunni war. Most Sunnis have seen their brothers and sisters being butchered by Hezbollah and Assad, both are Shiites, and they've been butchering our brothers and sisters in Syria. And therefore, basically, when 2006, when Hezbollah was fighting with Israel, believe it or not, most Jordanians or Palestinian Jordanians were on Israel's side. They wanted to see Hezbollah suffering. They wanted to see Hezbollah dying. Of course, it's not the case for Palestinians in the West Bank. But the most conscious struggle and hatred today is between Sunni and Shiites. And I said a year ago that the best option would be to support the Sunni fundamentalists in fighting the Shiite fundamentalists and let them do one another. But it doesn't mean that Mr. President Obama will listen to me.
Yeah, Mudar, I have a couple questions for you here. And let me just make one comment to what you just mentioned with regards to oil revenues. It's my understanding that with the sanctions that were in place on Iran and the relaxation that Obama has been almost on his own encouraging or doing, he has been responsible for the release of billions of dollars to Iran. We don't have an exact figure, but we believe it's anywhere from, say, $6 to $12 billion, which is a significant figure. So it's almost like Obama's not helping the situation. Otherwise, I agree with what you said on that point. So I have a couple questions here. One would be, I've noticed in the media, we've seen many beheadings done by the Islamic State and these horrific videos, but in almost every case it's been a journalist. And while there's been a response, the condemnation has only gone so far. However, we see it seems to be different with this pilot. And so could you please just touch on why you think it may be more impactful to the world that this Jordanian pilot has been so brutally massacred as opposed to some of the journalists who have come under a same or similar fate? And then also, I'd like to also expand into the conversation some of the differences that you see in the Palestinian people themselves from the West Bank to the Gaza. In other words, the difference from those who are in the West Bank and those who are in Gaza. And also, as we try to look for resolution, are we looking for different plans for Gaza than we are with the West Bank, or would the same work for both, or is one a lost cause, is one not? You know, I'd like to just expand that to help educate our audience, please.
Well, thank you very much for asking such a very intellectual question. The death of the Jordanian pilot has been very epic, because he died while actually bombing ISIS. And he died after using state-of-the-art American aircraft that was shut down in a very mysterious fashion. That's where the intrigue began. In addition, the actual execution, you know, burning him alive and him reciting Islamic prayers before he got burnt, people noticed he was holding his hands. And what few non-Muslims realize that the man was actually doing what most Muslims are supposed to do before they die, which is recite a certain part of the Quran. So it was epic to see Islamists killing a Muslim while he prays and burning him alive in such a fashion. So the intrigue into the whole concept was very epic, to be honest with you. And that's what drives the concern. In addition, that this is a Muslim being killed by another Muslims, and he was not any Muslim. I think many in the media have reported that the young man, rest in peace, was a very Orthodox Muslim. He performed Hajj. He's been to Hajj several times. He prayed five times a day. He memorized the Quran by heart. He memorized the Quran, all 500 pages of the Quran. He memorized them by heart, which shows you how ISIS treats Muslims too. So this is the epic side of why it was more interesting to the media about it. And for the record, he has visited Israel. He has photos online of himself before the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Temple Mount. So quite a character that young man was. Now, what will this mean in the future? ISIS is not stupid. ISIS, as much as evil as they are not stupid. For example, Hitler was a very evil man, and he did a lot of stupid things. ISIS is not stupid by any chance. They are very calculating, very smart, and very, very, very ahead of others. And the death of the pilot gave them exactly what they wanted. They wanted to terrorize other Muslims, and they wanted to drag Jordan to the war at any cost. And it's happened, and that's what ISIS wants. They wanted Jordan, and it's happened. They got their wish.
It's actually pretty scary because, as I made in my opening comments, it seems to me it puts a lot at risk because one of the things you have here, Forbes just recently put out a list of the top 10 terror organizations by funding, right, by their ability to finance their operations. Because let's be clear, while terrorism is a lot less expensive than the defense, terrorism still does require capital. The number two and number four on that list, number one was ISIS. And because, as you point out, they're very smart and they've done a very astute job of not just stealing wealth, taking over banks and things, but they've actually been undermining local efforts to defeat them because they've actually been selling on black market. But the number two is Hamas and the number four is Hezbollah. Both of whom have been getting – Hamas has always been an Iranian puppet, but Hezbollah, you know, kind of goes back and forth, right, it's, you know, to whether or not Iran is supporting it or not. But so to open up a third front of tension on the border of Israel clearly is in ISIS's best interest, as I pointed out, because, you know, they would stand to gain the most out of such chaos. Do you see any efforts among the Jordanian people and or the broader Palestinian people in sort of recognizing the associated risks of having such radical groups, or do many of them still just look at, well, if Hamas and Hezbollah are primarily bashing Israel, they don't equate them as the same kind of violent terrorists that they would frame ISIS?
Okay, the Palestinians in Jordan are secularist. They have their own Western lifestyle. They hate Israel, but not necessarily more than many Western European countries do. And they are very mesmerized by ISIS taking over. And this was actually even before the butchery of the pilot. The Palestinians in the West Bank have become institutionally radicalized to the point where I was spending a lengthy time in the West Bank last summer, I've heard and seen things which go beyond ISIS. People have lost their mind, basically. The Palestinians in Gaza, they have had enough of Hamas. they found out that Hamas is terrorizing them, abusing them, using them openly as human shields, and they would actually want to get rid of Hamas at any cost or leave Gaza at any cost. Someday, if my hopes come true, and there is a secular Palestinian president in Amman, all that president should do is just use or actually fulfill the Jordanian citizenship laws. Jordanian citizenship law, Article number 2, states that all non-Jewish Palestinians or all Palestinians who are not Jews are natural-born Jordanians. So the Palestinians who are homeless in Lebanon and Syria, they, in other scenarios, if the king was to apply the law, all they had to do is just walk into the Jordanian embassy, get their passport, and go back home. The Gazans, we must, this is my actually commitment and promise, if we ever make it to power in Jordan, we will open the gates completely to Gazans, and we will consider them our citizens under a disaster. And we would actually treat them the way FEMA would treat people under a hurricane, and welcome them home. This will basically empty Gaza from population, and those who Hamas wouldn't allow to go out would put Hamas under incredible pressure and embarrassment because it's not letting them go. The Palestinians in the West Bank, we are against any forced transfer of the Palestinians out of Israel. That would be ethnic cleansing, which I know Israel is not even considering. Israel will not do that. Could have done that long time ago if it wanted to. But we will offer them jobs and employment because, you know, I've done a study which I'm going to publish very soon. As it turns out, the king nets $20 billion a year to his pocket from the Jordan's budget. If those, the king is gone and those go back to the people, we will have welfare programs. Basically, we want a welfare Jordan that's armless and defenseless. We don't need the army. Honestly, the Americans have been doing most of our protection. Even the fight with ISIS is going to be, you know, we're going to use special forces. We're not going to be using tanks. So all what we need is basically a police force or another version of the Swiss army. We don't need this army we have today, 1,250 tanks Jordan has. We have a huge machinery which we never use. And that never came into value and cost us $3.5 billion a year. Once we get Jordan to become demilitarized, economically dependent and extended to Israeli economics, that's what we will get. And eventually, the majority will have the say on voting what to actually, you know, name the country, a new name for the country. This could happen, you know, when you talk to people like, APAC, for example, who are very traditional, as far as I see, very conservative, they and very liberal on certain issues. They will not listen to this. They will go like, this is a fairy tale. Well, who has ever thought an Egyptian president would take over from the Islamists, and the serendipity that Israelis found in Sisi is incredible. To the point where this Egyptian president is offering to absorb Gazans and give them half of Sinai as a state. So imagine if you have, that's the right guy in Amman. People with concerns about Jordan's future, I mean, as you can see with evidence today, with clear evidence that the king has no say over the army. And what are you afraid of if he has no say over the army? And he's spending exactly, this is documented. He's spending over 80% of his time out of the country. So what is it that they're missing with the king? Have they dined and wined too much with the king? They're afraid to see him go? Change is coming. You didn't have to believe me. The Mossad, less than a month ago, was reported to have said that they think Jordan's king is going to lose the kingdom sooner or later. So change is coming. It's like a train that's going to arrive. Could be sooner, could be later. Jordan's going to change. Israel, supporters of Israel, peace lovers, American Jews, non-American Jews, American Zionists, etc., they should be looking at a different option. And here I can
confirmed this information through my sources, and I have even written an article, a documented article about it. Turkey's Erdogan is now promoting behind the scenes a senior Muslim Brotherhood member in Jordan to become the next leader of Jordan. He is smart enough to be friends with the king, too close to the Jordanian army, and at the same time promoting someone he likes to be the next person. While what we see from the like American Jewish side or the American side, they're just being friends with the king. They know one person. If, God forbid, he dies tomorrow, they don't even have an address for the next person in line.
That's very interesting. Madar, I have again, just a few questions here. One actually coming from one of our listeners who raised a very good point. So I'll bring that up first, and then I'll mention the other two. But it seems like at least the Obama administration had been focused on ensuring that Mubarak was removed from office, now the Yemeni president, going after Assad, Gaddafi's gone. And what would prevent that same strategy from really seeking to remove the King Hussein, which, you know, maybe even though they seem to have this friendship, who knows what's really in the back of his mind? So then my other two parts are, you mentioned the Muslim Brotherhood in Turkey. Now, I personally have issues with the Muslim Brotherhood, and I think there's a connection there to the White House, and it almost ties into what I just said, because I think the Muslim Brotherhood is probably one of the biggest problems that exist in Gaza right now, amongst other places. But here's a question I have. In a lot of these Middle Eastern countries or nations, you have this divide between the different factions of Islam and other religions that exist in the area. So if all of the peoples who are either Jordanian or Palestinian or whatever that you would like to bring into the fold in Jordan, if some of them come from different types of sects, what is to prevent having all these people in one place from the same type of uprisings and confrontations and differences from expanding into another revolution, another civil war, or just ongoing problems like we see in some of these other nations? Or do you think that it's not as much of a divide amongst these people that you're talking about?
Well, the majority of Jordan and the majority of Palestinians are Sunni Muslims. 97% are Sunni Muslims. And the majority of Jordan, 88% are Palestinians. And when we hopefully bring our citizens from Lebanon and Syria, that's going to drive the majority into above 90%. So they are very harmonious in their religion and ethnicity and sectarian affiliation or denomination. Therefore, I can't see the roots for trouble. And with without trouble, people are afraid of chaos in Jordan after the king goes. They need to know that the king is already gone. He spends, and you just need to check his official Twitter account. He spends 80% of his time out of the country, so he has no stay on the stability. It's the Jordanian army that calls the shots. Bottom line, who kept Egypt in check? Who has kept Egypt stable, despite a few things here and there? The army. Who has destroyed Yemen? Why did Yemen become a mess? Because the army has collapsed. Why was Libya? Why is Libya now a terrorist beehive? Because the army has been dismantled. And same was with Iraq back in 2003. So the army is the key, and the army is under direct American control. And I don't think, as much as you and I might disagree with President Obama, I don't think the president sees any interest in dismantling Jordan's army. There are four American bases, 12,500 American soldiers on Jordanian soil, and that's why it's America would never seek a destabilization of Jordan. Only that America, the CIA, the establishment, they know that the king is irrelevant. So if there is eventually a push by either the people or the army to let him go, they're just going to let him go. That's the bottom line.
Madar, we've got about 8 minutes left with you, so I'm going to try to move through a couple of questions Brett and I have at a pretty good clip. First, I have a super fast question and then one with slight detail. The fast question is, I want you to just tell me relative to the death of the two terrorists that Jordan put to death. Is capital punishment normally allowed in Jordan?
Yes, capital punishment is allowed. It was stopped or abolished somewhat by the king for 9 years, and it came back a month ago. And yes, it's allowed. So it all went properly through the Jordanian legal system.
Good. And of course, I want to remind our listeners, these were convicted terrorists. So this wasn't like some crazy vengeful killing. But let me turn focus to something I think is very important. And I want to understand your perspective on this. Abbas, as we've discussed in at least three interviews with you, has really been an enormous disappointment and failure, and really has just been propped up by the West, maybe for consistency's sake, if nothing else. You have another power broker there who's been marginalized by Abbas, Mohammed Dahlan. What do you see as the likely power structure? Who else might be a legitimate power broker there? And is Mohammed Dahlan likely any better, or is he just another kleptocrat, in absentia?
Okay, Mohammed Dahlan is a very pragmatic man. I've met the gentleman once in Jordan. I know the details of who he is. He is very intellectual. He's very anti-Islamist. He is the senior advisor for United Arab Emirates King, and he has actually masterminded the fall and collapse of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and elsewhere. The man is a genius. That's why he's not allowed in Jordan. That's why Jordan's king has confiscated his property in Jordan, and he has done an incredible job cracking down on Hamas while in Gaza, and cracking down on terrorism in the West Bank under the Palestinian Authority. That's why Abbas got rid of him. I see a genuine partner in Dahlan. The only difference is Dahlan would wish to seek a Palestinian state inside Israel, and that may not be my idea of a solution. The man is very credible, and he's a true partner of peace, as much as I might disagree with him. He is a man to work with, and he has a track record of that.
John?
Yep. I'm sorry,
oh,
Brad. I was expecting you to jump in. Your turn.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yep. Mudar, going back to the Muslim Brotherhood and the White House, I want to go back to the speech that the president gave in Cairo, because I really believe that that was one of the key events responsible for really setting the Middle East on this downward spiral. Because it seemed to me, if you add Iran into the conversation, you had an uprising in the streets of Iran, which he chose to be absolutely silent on, but then gave a speech in Cairo really giving rise to the power rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in that region, which also therefore kicked off the Muslim Brotherhood impact that is in Gaza and the Sinai and other places. And you've also simultaneously over the last few years seen a more vigilant or more radicalized, leader in Erdogan in Turkey. And I bring this up because I honestly believe that while you and I may not, we may agree on a lot of things, but there's some things we may not. And certainly Jordan and Israel may never be more than, a certain level of friendship. Maybe they could agree to coexist side by side, even with these changes that we're proposing. But I do believe that the Muslim Brotherhood is a cancer that could be very harmful to that equation. And I also believe, and I've made this pretty clear, I think, that Barack Obama is also that same type of cancer. And I just find it odd that he is so attached to them. And I'd still like to cover more of what your thoughts are on that and their involvement.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood, I cannot absolutely explain President Obama's approval of them. There has been, all kinds of, wild stories about the president being an undercover Muslim, etc. But I know one thing. I know, unfortunately, whether this might shock you or not, the U.S. establishment's appeasement of the Muslim Brotherhood began during President Bush's era. The Muslim Brotherhood headquarters, global headquarters, is in Jordan under the watchful and approving eye of Jordan's king. And those were, according to WikiLeaks cable, were in touch. They began, U.S. Embassy, Department of State, has began contacted them as early as 2005. And they have been basically in bed together. And why is Obama doing that? There is all kind of theories, including that the U.S. establishment believes that they're trading one evil versus another, which is instead of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they can use the more quote-unquote moderate Islamists, which is, you know, choosing to death with, you know, a cobra versus a death with a less venomous snake. And it's not, at best, it's a very unintelligent strategy. At worst, it's a conspiracy. And for example, 3 years and a half ago, there was a report of the CIA meeting with the head of the Jordanian Muslim Brotherhood in Turkey, and that he was offered, quote-unquote, to take over Jordan in a revolution, supported him in making a revolution against the king and taking over Jordan as long as he establishes ties with Israel. So how come none, the U.S. Department of State still refuses to even speak to us, the Jordanian seculars? They refuse to acknowledge we exist. The U.S. Embassy Amman tolerates comments from people on its Twitter accounts, tolerates Islamist and even terrorist comments, and even people, you know, trashing America and Americanism. For some unknown reason, the U.S. Embassy Amman has blocked me on Twitter. So it shows you to go the extra mile to block me on Twitter. It shows you basically that they want nothing to do with us. Allow me just to conclude. It doesn't help when we see, unfortunately, some American Zionists also standing against us instead with us.
Yeah, no, and that's a good point. Midar, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I have to ask you, this conversation that we have with you is so important that we're going to have to do this in the same manner and more often and hopefully very soon. And so I want to thank you, but please give your Twitter handle so people can check out some of the things that you are working on.
Well, I much appreciate what you're saying, and I look forward to being with you again. Thank you very much.
Okay, and thank you again, Mudar. We'll talk to you soon, and have a great
evening. Thank you. God bless.
All right. Bye-bye. You too. Well, folks, we are at the end of the program. I've used up the entire time. We'll be back again tomorrow, and, of course, you'll want to listen to this interview again as we post it on our social media. Have a great afternoon, and that is a wrap.
The Final Say Radio Show is an original broadcast of Rappaport Media. To hear more The Final Say podcast, go to www.thefinalsay.com.